Accession number 9794, reel 4.
Mr. Lewis, reel 4.
In fact, what happened was that in our desire to do everything possible to deliver our agent to the south of France, we probably pressed on a little too much. We were in, as I say, we were in continual cloud. There's a lot of high ground between the north of France and the south of France. We had to fly above the high ground. In short, a lot of ice formed on the aircraft. Aerodynamics were altered. Engines caught fire. They were extinguished with the use of the Gravina switch, but unfortunately that meant that we were down to two engines, losing height very rapidly over high ground in the area of Valence, in the Rhone Valley, just below Lyon, and reluctantly we had to advise our agent, passenger, to get out. We tried to throw everything we could out of the aircraft to see if it would maintain height, but in the end, we ourselves had to jump for it, and indeed, all of the crew successfully bailed out and survived the landing. We landed, or we were flying, or I landed in a small snowbound hilly area just a few miles north and east of Valence. I won't go too long into the story, but I was given help. I walked for a while, saw that I was in a very remote area, but I did find a house. I didn't knock at first, but having explored the area for another hour or so, decided that was the only house in the vicinity. So I went back, knocked at the door. I was allowed into the house eventually by a nervous lady and her daughter.
Did you tell them who you were?
I did, and that frightened them even more. Not that they were afraid of me from the Royal Air Force, but they knew, having been occupied for something like, I suppose, 4 years, they knew what the consequences were going to be if they were discovered giving shelter to an airman. Nevertheless, bless them, they allowed me into the house and let me stay there that night. I gathered that their respective husbands, the lady in the house probably was somewhere around about maybe 40, mid-40s, and she had a daughter in her early 20s who was also married, I gather, but both of their husbands had been directed by the Germans into some sort of factory work or war work. I don't think they even quite knew where they were at that stage, but they certainly weren't living at home. I was given one of their suits of clothing and a pair of shoes. They went into the fields and rummaged around and found my parachute, which they were glad to have. And indeed, I was allowed to sleep the night in this remote house. I went to bed, and I think, as far as my own feelings were concerned, I knew that nothing very much could happen to me now. I could have been made, if I was caught, I was going to be made a prisoner of war, but I was determined, if possible, to get back to England. I think what worried me most was the fact that my mother, who I had never dared tell. I'd started on another tour of operations. She thought I was doing some innocuous training. Thing was going to get a nasty telegram in the morning saying that I was missing, and I think that really worried me as much as anything. In fact, it did worry me more than anything. Anyway, in the morning, the lady, the mother, the elder lady, had vanished from the house, and I must say I had reservations. I thought, now, has she really had second thoughts and gone to turn me in? But I had a bit of faith in them, and I waited, and eventually she returned with a man, and they had bicycles, and I rode off with this man on bicycle. I must have ridden quite a few miles, but eventually we landed up in a small village, and we were taken into the back room of a pharmacy, and within 48 hours I was with three other members of my crew in that pharmacy. They had been collected from various points.
By now disguised as a French civilian?
They were all in civilian clothes. I was in a suit, yes, and they were all wearing civilian clothes.
Did you know anything about the chap who'd taken you on the bicycle? Was he a member of the resistance?
No, I knew nothing about him at all.
So what happened next?
Within 24 hours, and I can't be any more precise than that, I was nervous of the fact that obviously we were doing rather special work anyway, and the less we became involved with the civilians and the less we knew about them, the better. I just felt that, and I think we all agreed that, because we weren't really sure what the reactions of the Germans would be to us. If they caught us, they must have guessed what we were up to for an aircraft to be flying in that sort of area. And so we didn't make too many inquiries. I just remember, all I can remember very distinctly was the name over the top of that pharmacy, which was Jean Chancel. And it stuck in my mind.
How do you spell Chancel?
C-H-A-N-C-E-L. Anyway, within 24 hours of going there, in walks a man dressed in the uniform of the American Marines. And in fact, he was a captain in the American Marines. His name was Peter Ortiz. He was an agent, the OSS.
Yes.
And in fact, if you read SOE in Europe, you know the book, M.R.D. Foote's book, you will see a reference to Peter Ortiz in the book and his capacity for walking around in occupied France wearing the American Marines uniform, which in fact we saw many times after that. I mean, it still surprises me to this day. But anyway, this American Marine came to see us. He was very, very wary of us. Not at all certain that we were who we were. He was obviously a tough character. A frightening character in a way.
Why was he frightening?
Well, I suppose as it turned out, I mean, subsequently he was a soldier of fortune. He'd been operating in the Spanish Civil War. He was a tough guy, and either we were just a damn nuisance to him, having turned up in his territory. He wasn't there to look after airmen on the run. He got something more important to do, presumably. And B, I think he was just wary in case we were going to be turn out to be the enemy that were, you know, trying to filter our way into into his world.
Did you feel he might not take any risks and bump
certain,
you off?
Certainly, without any doubt whatsoever. Certainly, especially as he was well armed anyway. I mean, he had guns in his belt, I remember very well. Anyway, he said, I shall come back and see you again. And these resistance people who in whose care we were, they were good to us, but by God, they made sure we didn't get away. You know, we were almost like prisoners there for a couple of days, but they fed us and looked after us well enough. But
how did Ortiz introduce himself and say what he was, if anything? Presumably he didn't say, I'm Peter Ortiz.
He didn't give us his name at that stage, but I'm quite certain that he let us know that he was an American major, you know, working, or captain, working for the Americans in that area. Oh, I'm quite certain. I can't remember exactly what happened, but I was never in any doubt as to what he was. And anyway, a couple of days later, or a day later, he came back again. We gave him all our details, and he said, yes, he said, I have established the fact that that the people with your rank and name have gone missing on a flight which would have taken you over this area, and what is more, do you recognize these people? And he showed us some photographs, and they were indeed the photographs of the other three members of our crew, who he had also seen, and who we gathered were located some distance away, closer to Grenoble, some long distance away. In fact, we were quite surprised that they were so far away. But anyway, he had made contact with them as well, or his somebody with whom he was working had provided him with these pictures. Anyway, he said, well, look, there's not very much we can do for you in the way of getting you back to England, but indeed you can't stay here, and we were taken up within a day or so up into one of the Mackie camps, up into the hills. We were in the, I suppose you would call that the Vercors up there. We were up in the hills. And in fact we stayed with them for about 3 weeks or so.
What was it like in the Mackie camp?
Well, it was very rough, in as much as it was February. We were up at a fair height. It was damn cold. It was deep snow and blizzarding all the time. We weren't ideally equipped. Personally, I mean, all we had was a suit of clothes and probably a pair of shoes on or something. The conditions in the camp, we were, as far as I remember quite well, we were in a sort of a loggish timber hut, all of us in this hut, sleeping in double bunks, one up and one down. And when I say all of us, I mean probably 40 of us or thereabouts. They were all young men with their Sten guns and things. And they foraged for food from the farmers and cooked for themselves and so forth around the campfire. And it was just a fairly tough existence for a few weeks. In fact, whilst we were up there, I mean, this is it's quite a staggering story. I tell this when I'm giving RAF speakers panel talks, and I think people sort of take it with a pinch of salt, but we used to go off occasionally with Peter Ortiz would come up occasionally. He brought us up some shaving tackle and things like that, always in his American uniform. He would come up to this camp, and he occasionally would take us out on a walk, or a climb, or a walk, whatever. We were just traversing. We may go down into a village and go into a bar and have a couple of cognacs, to warm us up for the return journey. But it was just a diversion for us, and I suppose perhaps when he wanted to get the heat off him, I don't know. But whilst we were there, apparently one of the young men in the Maquis camp had gone down into the village, and there were the milice, you understand what I mean?
Yes.
They were down there. He had blabbed his mouth off. He probably had too much to drink about some English airmen being up in the up at the camp, up the road. And in fact this young man was tried. The knowledge got back to the Maquis because one of the chaps in the milice was really doubling back information, and the Maquis had a little court-martial, and in fact they executed this this chap up at the camp whilst we were up there. Didn't see it, no. We heard it.
They shot him, did they?
Oh, they shot him, yes. And it was a very, very nasty experience for us, because we knew we were it was us that it was all about. The damage was done, because in the middle of the night, within a day or two, and I would think about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, we were woken up by Peter Ortiz, and it was rare. I mean, we were surprised to see him in the middle of the night. He didn't stay with us at all. He woke us up and he said, look, he said, you're being sought out. Germans are coming up for you. I've come to collect you, and we're moving you out. And in fact, he did say, if you see those lights down there, they are the vehicles of the Germans who, in fact, are on their way for you now. And so he had a car, and we got in this car, and he drove us some, I would guess, 20 or 30 miles south down the Rhone Valley. I'll come to that in a second. But that was the end of our stay with the Maquis. They hadn't done very much whilst we were there. I don't think they were very active. They were waiting, I think, their time for the invasion. Everybody was talking about the anticipated debarkment at that time. We used to sit up there. The weather was quite good when it wasn't snowing. And watch there was a German airfield at a place called Chabay, just down in the valley. And we could actually sit up there, watching aircraft take off, and they used to fly over the top of us.
Looking for you?
Certainly looking for Maquis, I think. Certainly keeping their eye on the Maquis. I don't think they were necessarily looking for us, but I'm certainly thinking they were keeping themselves well advised. And you will appreciate, you know the book Tears of Glory?
No.
You haven't read Tears of Glory. It's a very good book about the Maquis in the Vercors that rose up. They were anticipating the landing from the Middle East. Well, it was all these boys that I was with. It was just there. That I, and of course all of those chaps, they were all killed subsequently. Very sad. But anyway, we go on, and we were taken down by Peter Ortiz down to as far as a spot due east of Montélimar, which is further south in the Rhone Valley, to a little village probably about 6 or 8 miles from Montélimar called Dieulefit, Dieulefit. And the four of us were taken to the home of the doctor of the village. Now it transpired that the doctor had in fact been a regular medical officer with the French army. He'd served out his as a professional doctor with the French army, served most of that time in French Indochina. He spoke good English. He had a good collection of English books, fortunately. And for the next few weeks, we were shuttered up in one room upstairs in this little house. Downstairs was his consulting room. There were people in and out the place all the time. On Sundays, he ran a little Bible class or Sunday school for children. They were Protestant family. And we were left to our own devices there. We were eating their food. We were very conscious of it. There were only the doctor and his wife and two nieces who were girls of about 17, 18 years of age who were, as I now know, acting as couriers for the local resistance on their bicycles. They were still at school. They were learning English at school, and they used to come and practice on us, and we would chat away to them. And we were there for 4 weeks, getting very impatient, really, because we wanted to get on our way. I mean, our only interest was getting back to England, and we were determined, by hook or by crook, that we would get back, and we were getting to the stage where we felt that we would really break out. We hadn't seen Peter for some weeks, that we would have to break out from this house and take our luck and try and find our way to the Pyrenees, which we knew was the only way we could get back home. Anyway, one Saturday evening, Peter Ortez turns up. By that time, it's an extraordinary war. He was wearing major's crowns, no longer a captain. And we noticed this and congratulated him. He said, well, as a matter of fact, I got my promotion, and an aircraft making one of the drops one night dropped me my new insignia as well. It's funny the way things happened during the war. And he said, tomorrow, Sunday, you'll commence making your journey back, hopefully, to England. He came and collected us on Sunday, took us back to Valence. That evening, he travelled with us on a train all the way round to Carcassonne. He handed us over to somebody on Carcassonne station. We took a little electric train up in a little way up into the towards the Pyrenees, and after a short rest, we commenced a walk that was going to occupy us more or less, I think, save for two nights, for a week. We just walked and walked and walked in the company of about 40 other people. We were the only English people, the four of us, but there were people from all corners of Europe waiting to get into Spain for all sorts of reasons. There were people from Poland, from the Balkan countries, from all areas. There were a number of American airmen who had been shot down on daylight raids in the area of Bordeaux, in that part of France. And we traversed the high points of the Pyrenees, skirting Andorra. I know the route because I went back there just a few months ago. And in fact, for the first time, after 40 years, I met the guide that took us across. It was quite a thrilling moment for the Spaniard. And eventually, after a week or so, we got down into Spain. We spent a couple of days living fairly rough in a farmhouse there, and then taken on a lorry one Sunday afternoon with a tarpaulin thrown over the lot of us, and we were dropped outside the consulate in Barcelona. from there, after a couple of days, to the embassy in Madrid, where they gave us some, after a week or so, we got some very good papers, which enabled us to travel by train down to La Linea, and we went through the gates with the workers in the morning into Gibraltar, hence back to England.
So there was no question of these Spaniards interning you?
We missed all of that, because the route was so well planned that we never got into the hands of anybody that would intern us. Many of my friends have been interned and went to the famous Miranda prison, but we were handled so well that it never happened to us.
But you mean you would have been interned if you had fallen into the hands of the authorities?
Oh, I'm sure, yes. I'm sure.
Whilst you were escaping across France to the Pyrenees, or at any other time you were in France, did you have any narrow escapes with the Germans or...
Yes. certainly, the train journey, as you may know, from Valence to Carcassonne, it runs down the Rhone Valley until it hits Avignon, and then follows the coast around almost to the Spanish border, where it cuts inland to Toulouse and eventually to Carcassonne. When we were running around the coast, I suppose that was a reasonably well-defended area. We got to, I'm not sure whether it was Narbonne or Béziers, but it was one of those two towns there. And it must have been about, I guess, it was just breaking daylight anyway. It was probably 7 o'clock in the morning or thereabouts, because it was still March. when we were horrified to see several hundred German soldiers on the platform waiting for the train. We knew darn well that we were bound to come. And in fact, they got onto the train. They came and sat in our carriage. And we really were quite horrified. We were in four corners of the carriage. But we just felt that we were going, you know, the game was up. But nevertheless, we sat it out. And they more or less ignored us. And we bluffed our way through. And in fact, they got out again somewhere else. They didn't come all the way to Carcassonne. But that was quite a scaring moment. And again, when we went up in the little electric train up into the Pyrenees, there were quite a number of... And they were just, that was just a small train of two or three coaches, as far as I remember. And there were quite a lot of German soldiers on that train. And
so when the Germans came into your compartment, they didn't attempt to engage you in conversation?
I don't think they were even French speaking, as far as I remember. But they may have, I don't know, could have offered a cigarette or something. I can't recall, but exactly what happened. But certainly we avoided the only one amongst us that could speak any French at all worthwhile was our Canadian rear gunner. And any French that he spoke must have been pretty Canadian anyway. We were quite lucky.